If we're going to get started, calling to order the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. Today is Monday, March 10th. I apologize, we didn't get started on time. Is Representative Solberg in the room? He is not yet in the room. Who is? Representative Yarrow, please come up. I will move that House File 3454 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Representative Yarrow.
Thank you, Madam Chairlady and members of the committee. House File 3454 would make a simple amendment to the original Spirit Mountain Authority bill, which I authored back in ancient times, 1973, and the hill is still operating, which is great. What it is, it's just a simple, there was a mistake in the legal description, and you see the maps that you have here.
Yep.
What it does is, this plat of land should be part of the legal description, but instead, the blue one is. So we're just swapping the blue for the red and correcting that mistake of 1973 that we didn't realize until recently.
All right. Are there questions from members? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Yarrow, so is there any financial implications either to the park or to any property owners in this swap?
Representative Yarrow.
I don't think so, but go ahead. Kevin Wally, representing the City of Duluth.
All right. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Kevin Wally, representing the City of Duluth. Madam Chair, Representative Biskin, no, there is no financial implication for either the city, the Recreation Authority, or the landowners. The world has gone on since this error was made in the original legal description, and the red hatch mark area that you see is part of and has been part of the Spirit Mountain Recreation Authority. In fact, you can see the ski trails on the map here that have been operating, continue to do so. And the lands in blue that were part of the legal description will now be excluded appropriately are privately owned properties that have had no impact on this. It's been something that has been on the books in error, and no one's been aware of it. We're fixing it. Last year, we talked about doing it as part of the revisor's bill. The revisor's office said, no, this should go through the committee process, and so it's been introduced on its own as a separate bill and come, I think, appropriately to this committee.
All right. Questions from members? Anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3454 be recommended pass and be placed on the general. Yes, Representative
Olson.
Oh, Representative Olson, I didn't see you there. Sorry.
Representative Olson. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious, if we didn't pass this, would that mean that a lot of people would have some nice real estate on the slope?
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, no, I don't believe that would be the case. I think the confusion would be over the ownership with respect to the area that's hatched in blue, which private owners believe they own, and now there's a law that's been on the books for over 30 years that purports to have that land be part of a public authority, which it's not. So the land that was on the hillside there that should be in the part of the legal description was publicly owned property before the Spirit Valley Recreation Authority was established, and so there's no consequence on that.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I don't mean to belabor this, but it does bring to mind a question I've had for a long time, and maybe staff can answer it. Does the state of Minnesota have a squatter's rights provision?
No. Representative Biskin, we don't know.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'll go on wondering for a while longer.
All right. Further questions from members? All right. With that, again, I will renew my motion that House File 3454 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
All right. I am in the understanding that Representative Gunther actually has some place to be. So if Representative Gunther would please come to the table, we will move on your bill. to which one? Senate. Representative Lanning, will you move Senate File 2909?
So moved.
And this will be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Gunther, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Kelstrom and members, this is a rather simple bill, and I'm surprised we have to pass a bill to have this happen. But basically, what the bill does is it gives the tenants right to pay the utility bill if the landlord doesn't. And after the tenant has to provide sufficient notice to the landlord, and they have to notify the utility company. But this bill is so well loved. It's the Multi-Housing Association, Legal Aid, Xcel Energy, and Centerpoint Energy are all in approval of it, and I just think it's the thing to do.
Question.
We don't want people to freeze.
All right, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gunther, does this then give the tenant the right to deduct those bills from their rent?
Madam Chairman, Representative Olson, that's exactly right.
Thank you. I think it's a good bill.
Good one.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lanning renews his motion that Senate File 2909 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
All right, Representative Solberg.
I do not have a witness from other counties.
I feel like I've been wrong.
I can be deferred if you want.
You're up.
Okay.
Representative Solberg moves that House File 3295 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair and members, I do not have a witness come down for this particular meeting. I was down for the first one. The Grand Rapids Economic Development Association is a group appointed by the city, and they were always under the impression that their conflict of interest was similar to everyone else's conflict of interest, like housing and urban development, a HUD appointee. And their membership has been people of standing in the community as they look at the community activities, and they have a broad spectrum of, and some of my business people that are on the committee, and they received a grant from the Blandon Foundation, and then the grant is to be used for loans for businesses, low interest loans for businesses in the downtown district to be able to improve their storefronts and fix up buildings. And when they found that out, that one of the gentlemen that served on the EDA, a very active person, happens to own a window business in Grand Rapids, and found out that he could not be on the EDA and then sell a window to anybody that's got any one of these loans. Even though he would disclose that he would probably, you know, have a conflict of interest in this, he couldn't even serve. So this bill adopts the same standard, the same type of conflict of interest language that's in the HUD language. If he had a direct conflict of interest, disclose it beforehand, all the things that go on into, as we do in conflict of interest. And I think it's a piece of legislation that's why the EDAs were different than other committees that are appointed by the cities is something I don't understand, but I received a unanimous support in the previous committee. So with that, I would appreciate your support and stand for questions.
Questions from members. Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Solberg. So just to get this straight online, page 1, line 14, the verbiage substantially affected the commissioner's or an employee's financial interest is identical to that already in law.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair and Representative Diskin, my understanding is that this case, I have not looked at the verbatim language of the HUD, but that's my understanding.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll look through that, and if it is different, Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I will alert you of
sure.
That difference.
Great. Further questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Solberg renews his motion that House File 3295 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Solberg.
Thank you.
Is Representative Broad in the room? Representative Magnus?
The grab still is, baby.
Representative Lanning, would you like to move Representative Magnus' bill?
Representative Magnus' bill, by 3831.
Representative
Holder? To answer Representative Distance's questions, Council says it is the same.
All right. Thank you. Representative Lanning moves House File 3831 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And we had the House, the body heard several of these today. I expect there'll be more coming. It's a it's my bill allows Rock County to appoint the auditor treasurer. And I'm not sure if all of these that we did today in the House floor have this stipulation in also, but we do include the reverse referendum. And we do include a resolution that if at least 10% of the registered voters in the county provide this resolution, that there will be an opportunity for the members of the county to vote and not carry forward with it. So with that, Madam Chair, it's basically what we've been doing recently in the floor.
All right, questions for members. Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Magnus, on both of the bills on the House floor today, there were amendments brought up on your page 2, lines 1 and 2, where there is the requirement to publish the resolution. The amendment said, along with publishing the intent to make that change, they would also add information saying that a referendum of the people, the reverse referendum, is possible. Would you be opposed to that sort of amendment?
No, Madam Chair, it's Representative Diskins, I would not, and I would not oppose that sort of language. I will quote, Madam Chair and members, I will quote a letter from the county administrator and the Rock County Board of Commissioners. In part, it says, we would respectfully request that you present legislation authorizing the appointment of the auditor treasurer with the standard language allowing for reverse referendum. This appointment is also endorsed by the current Rock County Auditor Treasurer Gloria Roloff, that I've had several discussions with her. Their concerns have been with the requirements that the auditor treasurer has nowadays. And Rock County recently went through an audit of the program, not critical of anything the auditor had done, the auditor treasurer had done, but ended up costing the county about $30,000. And they still are increasingly concerned about scrutiny over the program. And frankly, someone can run for office now and not be an auditor. And so that's a concern Rock County has.
Further questions?
Yeah.
Representative Biskin.
All right, Madam Chair, then just I'll work with Representative Magnus to get that same verbiage in his bill so that when it comes to the House floor, I would hope Representative Magnus makes that an author's amendment, and that'll just smooth grease the skids as we go forward.
All right, Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Magnus, as I'm in these committees. Question: why doesn't the county just, an election's coming up in November? Why don't they just put it up to the vote of the people in November?
Madam
Representative
Chair, Magnus. Representative Marquardt, that's a good question. And I would encourage them to do that. But you know how these go, and the county's ask you to do this.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, because I know Representative Biskins and Representative Lincheski and I, we're on the losing end of this. In fact, we only got 42 votes on the no side today on the House floor, and I think it's been going down with every year. But why doesn't someone just come in now and put us out of our misery and just go into Chapter 375A and just say, if they want to do it, let them do it, and then at least we don't have to go through the torture twice or three times a year. And now I see another one's coming up, and just put us out of our misery once and for all on this one. So, I mean, just someone do 375A and just make it so they don't have to have the referendum. That's in fact, I almost could make that motion, just put myself out of this, but I won't do it. I won't do it. Someone should.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, who made the motion? Representative Lanning will renew his motion that House File 3831 be recommended pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lanning.
Thank you for your support.
All right, is Representative Broad in the room yet? No. Okay. Representative Junkie, are you in here? Representative Lanning, it looks like you're up because no one else is in the room. Representative Lanning, go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Maury Lanning from Moorhead and Lake County. The bill you have before you, and I would move the bill, by the way, Madam Chair.
Representative Lanning, where would you like it to be moved to?
Well, what is the pleasure of the committee? Does it need to go?
Consent calendar, Madam Chair?
Well, Representative Lanning, why don't you go ahead and make your presentation, and we'll have some discussions with
okay.
the chair. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this bill addresses, I think, a serious problem we have in the state of Minnesota relative to our management of water resources. And if the page could please pass out to members a copy of a couple of maps. What this bill is about is trying to get the state organized to better manage our water resources. If the state wants to do a better job of reducing flooding, if the state wants to clean up impaired water, if the state wants to reduce soil erosion, if the state wants to protect our water supplies and help meet our future water needs, we simply must be managing our water on a watershed and basin level. We're currently not doing that. Members, I call to your attention, first of all, this map, which shows the portions of the state that are currently organized as watersheds. Only about 30% of Minnesota's 84 watersheds are currently organized. Two-thirds of the state is unorganized when it comes to watersheds. On the other side of the map, we only have three of our nine river basins that have any kind of organization as a basin. And only one of those has major steps towards the organization of a river basin. And that happens to be my home basin, the Red River Basin. The Red River Basin has been organized really since back in the mid-1970s. We've had a Red River Water Management Board that is in statute, set up by the state of Minnesota, and they have taxing authority to be able to do flood mitigation projects and other water resource management projects. And they have had a very significant impact in dealing with the flooding issue over the last 30 plus years. Then, recognizing that our basin is not just in Minnesota, but also eastern North Dakota, portions of South Dakota, and Manitoba. In 1979, we started working with our North Dakota, South Dakota, and Manitoba counterparts trying to address problems on a basin-wide level. That year, we formed the International Coalition for Land and Water Stewardship in the Red River Basin. And that group involved citizens from throughout the basin that were coming together to try and address these problems. And then in 1996, we organized the Red River Basin Board, which involved local officials, state and federal and provincial officials from all of the four major subdivisions. And then in 2002, those two organizations merged to form the Red River Basin Board. So currently in the Red River Basin, we have a Minnesota Basin Board that is doing projects related to floods and other water resource issues. We have an international group Basin Board. And as a result of this basin organization, we, I think, have made major improvements in addressing water resource management issues. We have neighbors that have come together now to address these problems. The Red River Basin Board does not have any statutory authority, either in the United States or Canada, and yet by these neighbors coming together, studying the problems, trying to figure out what can we do to solve flooding or other water resource problems, we've been able to have a real major impact. And I think the state agencies will tell you that the existence of the Red River Water Management Board and the Red River Basin Board has been very instrumental in the state being able to do what it needs to do to better manage our water resources. I think we have demonstrated up in our part of the state that no county, no city, no watershed is an island, that what we do on a local level affects people that are our neighbors, downstream, upstream, affects those who are downstream. What I think we have demonstrated in our basin is that local governments have a stronger voice in affecting state and federal agencies when they're joined together with their neighbors to address water resource management problems. And I think we've also demonstrated that state agencies have a better opportunity to be able to work with local officials in trying to address those same problems. Now, I'd like you to just think for a moment from a city, county, soil and water conservation district perspective, a local government perspective. Right now, in our basin, if there's a problem, a city has a problem, a county has a problem, watershed has a problem, they have venues to go and address that problem. They can go to the watershed that's organized, they can go to the basin board, and they can work with their neighbors in trying to address that problem. But even in our basin, we've got a major watershed that's not organized. The Otter Tail is not organized. And 70% of the water that comes by our community comes from the Otter Tail. And so if there's a problem with the Otter Tail watershed, we don't have any direct mechanism to deal with those problems because they're not a part of the basin. Now, for most of the state, when a local unit of government has a concern about water quality, flooding, whatever the case might be, where do they go? If there's no watershed, where do they go? If there's no basin, as there isn't in most of the basins in Minnesota, where do they go? And it seems to me that what this bill does is to give local units of government an opportunity to work with their neighbors in trying to address these water resource problems. And let me just highlight a couple of specific provisions in the bill, and then I know we have a couple of folks who would like to testify on the bill. Thank you. What the bill basically says, and on state page 1, section 111 through 13, that the legislature finds that it is in the public interest to manage water resources from the perspective of watersheds and river basins to achieve protection, preservation, enhancement, and restoration of the state's valuable resources. It puts in statute that the best way to manage water is on a watershed or basin perspective. Then it talks about basin watershed management. All of the water resource problems that can be addressed or should be addressed from a basin perspective. They relate to water quality, water supply, flooding, groundwater resources, soil erosion, etc. And what the bill calls for is that there be a basin board established in each of the 9 basins of Minnesota. And these basin boards would consist of one representative from each of the existing watershed management organizations. And where there is no watershed management organization, counties or soil and water conservation districts could come together with a joint powers group and have then a representative on this basin board. And then each basin board, by January 1st of 2010, shall submit to Bowser their organization plan for that formation of a basin board. They're each supposed to set up an advisory committee, and then by January 1st of 2012, each basin board would adopt a water management plan, identifying their problems and how they go about trying to solve those problems. And then each watershed management organization is also called upon to do its plan by January of 2010. Then I call your attention particularly to 4, 17, 18, and 19. There's been a lot of concern expressed on the part of soil and water conservation districts about the duplication of plans. And what this provision allows for is that a county or water and soil conservation district could use the watershed plan as their plan so that they wouldn't have to duplicate that effort if they so chose to do so. Moving on to section 6, the basin board can adopt additional performance and operational standards. And this is consistent with what the legislation we passed last year with regard to Bowser and trying to improve accountability. And here, the next major provision of this bill is that in order for watersheds to be eligible for Clean Water Legacy, they need to be organized. The state doesn't have an unlimited amount of money to do all of what needs to be done with regard to Clean Water Legacy and cleaning up impaired waters. And so it seems to me we ought to give priority to those watersheds that are organized. And they would have priority consideration then in receiving Clean Water Legacy funding. With that, Madam Chair and members, that's a brief overview of the bill. And I know you have some names of folks who would like to address the legislation.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lanning. Are there questions? Representative Bolberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lanning, back to Section 6 where you talked about the Clean Water Legacy money.
Yeah.
And you talked about a priority, but as I read it, looks like there's a prohibition unless you're part of a basin plan. Is that correct?
Representative Lanning.
In order to have access to Clean Water Legacy funds, you would need to be organized as a watershed or as a joint powers organization. It doesn't have to be a watershed organization. It can be a joint powers where you've got counties and soil and water conservation districts that have formed a joint powers organization. And they then would be eligible for Clean Water Legacy.
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, then I'm trying to clarify this. I know in Lakeville, and I'm not even sure what the correct terminology, but we're part of like 3 different watersheds, the Vermilion River and Black Dogs one, and I can't think of what the 3rd one is. But so that would not be sufficient, you know, under this bill to receive any Clean Water Legacy. Is that correct?
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Polberg, are those are officially organized watersheds?
Oh.
Representative Polberg.
I'm sorry, I guess I'm not sure. They're, they cross county lines and they have taxing authority, but they're not a basin. I mean, they're not the, I mean, if you look at the, your map, they're not part of, you know, the whole basin isn't all together. But rather, there's subregions where the water from those particular areas drain into those Vermilion River. I think the Black Dog actually drains into the Minnesota River.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill would organize, all basins would be organized, so the basin board would be in place. Then, if you've got any watershed that is organized, and Mr. Jaski can address this as well, whether it's through a joint powers or an actual watershed organization, they would be eligible for Clean Water Legacy funding under this bill.
Representative Holder.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, absent the organization into the basin, so just say Dakota County and these different watersheds say, we don't want to be part of a basin. We got our management plans and we're, you know, we're doing our plan, et cetera. Under your bill, if it passed the way it's written, then they would be zeroed out of any opportunity for any Clean Water Legacy money. Is that correct?
Representative Lanning.
That's not my understanding. Mr. Jaski maybe has a response to your question as well.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is John Jaski, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources, and Representative Holbrook's question. Those watersheds are organized formally under a statute that has been in place since the early 1980s in the seven-county metro area. They aren't organized on a basin approach, and so if the requirement for legacy funding would require a basin approach, then they would not be. However, it required them to be organized formally on a watershed basis, then they would be.
Further questions from members? All right, seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward and state your name for the record. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Annalie Garlick, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I also work with the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators. Counties are not opposed to the idea of that better water quality management is needed. However, we do have some pretty big concerns about the structure of this bill. The basin boards that would be created would add an additional layer of governance and would be one more step for programs to go through, causing confusion in the implementation of lots of the programs and the planning and creating perhaps more delivery difficulties at the local level. We believe we need more stakeholders involved from all areas of the state. We have spoken with Representative Lanning about this along with some county commissioners from the different areas of the state, and we are very willing to make this a priority discussion over the interim to bring in all the areas. Representative Lanning mentioned that there's many areas of the state that don't have any sort of formal organizations. And we also see that we want to renew this discussion of how to better implement water quality activities throughout the state. But we do think that we need to bring in all of the areas of the state to be involved. So over the summer, we would like to pledge Representative Lanning and this committee that we will certainly discuss this, talk about different ideas that we have, and continue this discussion. But right now, we do have some pretty big concerns about the language as is.
All right, thank you. Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. That includes 13 of the state's larger counties. We share the same concerns that Ms. Garlick shared with you. We do concur that Representative Lanning has a very noble intent here, but before there are major changes in the governance regulation of water uses in the state, we believe that first you give an opportunity to for the changes that you made last session, both in terms of the Clean Water Legacy Act and the additional oversight authority that you gave to Bowser to operate before you look at adding this additional level of government with additional taxing authority statewide. But secondly, we think that there has to be a longer-term perspective looking at what is frankly a very fractured system of water regulation and governance. In many areas of the state, first in all areas of the state, there are at least two different planning entities, the counties and the soil and water conservation districts for water and soil erosion type issues. In portions of the state, you may have a third entity, the watershed district, or within the metropolitan area, the WMOs, watershed management organizations. And then further, certainly within the Twin City metropolitan area, you also have the cities performing that function. One of our larger concerns is really the efficiency of that type of operation. For example, in Washington County, an area in which all the geography is within either a WMO or a watershed district, there are seven different watershed districts, each with its own administrative staffing, each with separate contracts with the engineers that assist them in implementing and their plans. We think that, frankly, the system could be, our duties that are performed by the watersheds could be done in a much more efficient manner, and we think that that sort of view has to be put in play here before we start talking about the changes here. Again, I concur with Ms. Garlitz that we have had discussions with Mr. Representative Lanning and promise to work with him on the interim on the larger issues that we've identified here. With that, I'll end my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from members? All right, seeing none. Representative Lanning, first I want to thank you very much for all the hard work. Is there someone else? Please come to the table and state your name for the record. Is there anyone else? I just want to make sure we keep moving along here. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
My name is, Madam Chair, my name is Len Kramer. I'm the president of the Lower Minnesota River Watershed District, and I want to speak, talk about the issues and what's happening in the Minnesota River watershed as an example of why river basin commissions are needed in the state of Minnesota. We in the Lower Minnesota River watershed, we're at the bottom of the larger Minnesota River Basin. We were 44 miles in the river basin. There's 16,700 square miles of watershed above us. And we have a lot of resources in the Lower Minnesota River watershed. We have almost 12,000 acres of the Minnesota Valley Natural Wildlife Refuge. We've got boiling springs and kelp carious fens and trout, naturally reproducing trout streams. And through the middle of our watershed, we've got the dirtiest river in the state of Minnesota, and that's the Minnesota River. Some of the things that are happening, we have our river is impaired for many things, dissolved oxygen, phosphorus, suspended solids, and there's a PMDL underway to look at the suspended solids, and there's also the TMDL underway to look at phosphorus that's tributary to Lake Pepin.
I'm going to have to just shorten you and ask you, the only issues that we have to deal with in the local government committee are issues surrounding the governance of this board and those kinds of issues. So given the short time that we have before committee deadlines, I'm going to ask you to kind of talk about, you know, the bill and what it is that you expect would be impacted from local government.
Well, and Madam Chair, I guess what I'm saying is that the things that are happening in the Lower Minnesota River, to us, we have nowhere to go, as Representative Lanning has said. We've got suspended solids problems. We've got dissolved oxygen problems that are reducing the recreational value of our river, and we have nowhere to go. And you know, one of the things that we're responsible for is dredging the river for the navigation channel, and we're getting more and more sediment coming from the upstream watershed, and that's the result of changes in the agricultural community. We need a river basin commission to go to help us. When the PMDLs get done, a river basin commission is going to be absolutely needed to implement those CMDLs. And that's going to happen in 2009. Until, Madam Chair, that's just a brief summary of why we need a basin commission. And we, you know, we see all kinds of problems occurring, and we have no place to go.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Ron Harnack, representing the Red River Watershed Management Board. Representative Lanning referred to the Red River Watershed Management Board earlier. We do have a joint powers organization there currently. The value of a basin organization is not to duplicate what's being done at the local level. It's to provide a basin priority, goals, and objectives for the basin. In the Red River Valley, most of you know how flooding has been a significant issue. Yet if you look at the individual watersheds within the Red River, not all of them are created equal or contribute to flooding on an equal basis. So what the basin has done is provided a hydrologic model that allows for allocation of flood storage reduction for each of those watersheds. And it creates a framework of accountability so that everybody shares in achieving the broad goals of the basin for flood damage reduction. The same can be applicable for water quality. Every basin does not contribute evenly to the impairments in the Red River Basin. So our objective is to allocate to each of the watersheds a certain degree of responsibility for meeting the water quality goals for the Red River Basin. And then the levy that is applied goes back to helping implement those priority projects within the basin. It's a way and means in which we can share the responsibility and accountability for achieving our water quality and flood damage reduction goals for the basin. It's not duplicative. Ultimately, it would be our hope that you have a basin plan that has specific goals and objectives for achieving water quality and flood damage reduction. Then you've got individual watershed plans that share implementation with those units of government that have key roles. If it's counties, planning and zoning kind of things, if it's soil and water district, kind of the BMPs on the land, watershed districts for building the structural kind of component, so that you have a shared role and responsibility for implementing the goals and objectives for that basin. The state can't be everything to everybody, and I think there's an obligation for local units of government in basins to help share in the responsibility for achieving our water quality and flood damage reduction goals. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lanning, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't intend to push this forward at this point, but I wanted to have the bill presented because, folks, Minnesota needs to do a better job in managing our water resources, and if we're going to solve these problems like impaired waters, we've got to consider solving the problem through a basin-wide approach. And so I wanted to make you aware of this, and I intend to keep working on this. I've been consulting with all of the stakeholders, all the stakeholder groups. We'll continue to do that. And we're going to keep working towards having this legislation considered in the future. But thank you for listening today. And with that, Madam Chair, I would move that my bill be laid over.
All right. The chair will lay over. Representative Lanning, House File 2536. Thank you, Representative Lanning. Representative Broad, please come to the table. Representative Lanning, will you move that House File 2988 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes without recommendation?
Uh-huh.
Representative Broad, go ahead, state your name for the record. Representative Dunkey, you'll be next.
Madam Chair, Laura Broad, District 25A. I do have before you, and thank you for hearing House File 2988. Essentially, this is intended to solve a problem related to subordinate service districts. I'll frame it through a story from my own district, but we did craft the legislation to apply statewide. Essentially, in Washington Township, on the south side of my district, purchased some land for the purposes of a drain field related to a cluster septic system. They did this thinking that the opportunity to connect in with the Mankato system was a long ways off. Turns out they were able to connect in with the Mankato sewer systems and ended up not needing these 2 acres of land that they had purchased. They had assessed the property owners, 14 landowners, through the 365A process, and when they found out that they didn't need the land, there was no way for them to essentially dissolve or to dispose of these excess funds that were part of this district. So in consulting with the Township Association and also in related to an Attorney General's opinion, we do need to clarify and change the law to allow for the disposition of those excess funds. Please state your name for the record and go ahead. Sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sewell with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And while this bill did not originate through the association, we do appreciate Representative Broad's efforts to respond to her constituents' request. It is an issue that the town's attorney and I spent many hours on trying to find any possible process under the statute where they could rebate this money. Because the subordinate service district is created by a petition of the people for a particular heightened service that's not available township-wide. It's something that benefits just a small group of homeowners, and they voluntarily agree to pay a service fee or a surplus levy to cover this extended service. And so we felt it was fair that if they have the surplus for something that's being discontinued, that they have a mechanism to rebate it. And I did find some precedents under the general language for special assessments, that if a project is never built, you specially assess and never build a project, there is some authority to rebate that money at an, and so we try to use that as a guideline. And Representative Broad then brought it to the revisor's office to have it drafted. So I think it works. It needs to remain an optional provision, because in this particular situation, they've got plenty of money to warrant doing it. We wouldn't want them to have the cost bearing. If they only had $20 left, it wouldn't make sense to mandate it. The cost of administrating it would be too much. That's why it's drafted the way it is.
All right, questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lanning will renew his motion that House File 2988 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes without recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Broad.
Thank you.
Representative Junkie, I will move that House File 3574 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Back when I was in high school, this body was passing state building codes, and we think it's time we make sure that they are the uniform code across the state for cities above 2,500. And so that's simply what this bill does, is codify what folks in the Twin Cities don't understand this, because you've had it for years and years and years, and even do your own in some cities above and beyond this. But not everywhere in rural Minnesota is that the case. But certainly I think the time has come. It's a big consumer safety issue. Obviously we want plumbers and electricians and others understanding when they cross borders what the rules are, and this simply puts that in place. I wondered if it would be controversial in my county, and I found out already that my entire county has adopted them out in rural Minnesota, and that's true with a lot of the counties out there, so even with cities under 2,500, and they administer. So they are highly supportive of this, and since I've handed it in, I've had no one come to my office telling me they weren't supportive of it. So I think it's probably a good deal at this point. I do have an amendment, Madam Chair. I don't know if it's been distributed to get the bill in the shape I want it. Yep.
I would move the A1 amendment.
And Madam Chair, members, this is, if you go to the main page, which is 3, the first part just gives a way to use lumber from our small sawmills, whether you're in southeast Minnesota or west central where I'm from, or northern Minnesota. Wherever you have trees, you have small sawmills, and this just shows a way that they can certify and utilize that lumber in construction also. And then the bottom part is really just technical and cleanup language that you see.
All right. I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And, Madam Chair, I just have with me the Builders Association for answering questions or any additional testimony you may wish.
Would you like to make a statement or just questions? Just questions.
Madam Chair, just questions if anybody's got them.
I told her if it's passing to really be quiet.
Okay, questions from members. All right, hearing none. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please quickly come to the table and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank the author and the Builders Association for their work to help address local government concerns. The Delete All Amendment that you just adopted does do a number of things moving us toward that direction. We're going to continue working to make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences, and that would be the extent of our comments at this time.
Great. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3574 be recommended to pass and be as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Chair and members.
Representative Shumper. Representative Shumper moves that House File 3456 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Members.
Go ahead, Representative Shumper.
During the flood, we had a lot of mutual aid from other communities, including communities outside of Minnesota. And one of the things we discovered is that if at some point in the future communities in Minnesota wanted to provide mutual aid to other communities outside the state, there would be a problem of liability. Currently, it's allowed that state employees can provide this kind of mutual aid, but employees of cities and counties would have a real problem with liability, and this bill is to address and correct that. And I do have a witness here to explain the more specific legal aspects of that.
All right, go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Gergen. I'm an attorney with the League of Minnesota Cities and Associate Director of the League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust. We want to thank Representative Shumper for authoring this legislation. My testimony today will be brief in support of House File 3456. We view this really as a clarification of Section 192, which provides for that Emergency Management Assistance Compact, or EMAC, between Minnesota and the other states, as Representative Shumper has already indicated. EMAC really provides that framework for states to offer assistance to one another in times of emergencies. But as you can appreciate, much of the actual assistance that is provided is not by state employees, but rather by local government employees. So those local police, fire, EMS, even public works employees who then assist in another state. In general, those local government employees and local governments want to offer assistance when they can. It's in the nature of those emergency responders, it's in the nature of local government, it's in the spirit of public service. EMAC Section 192 provides a single point of reference and a single point of contact for coordinating and assigning the local government assistance that's going outside the state of Minnesota, and that point of contact is the state. So in other words, the cities and counties have to contact the state before they can then send assistance in another community. That single point of contact is a very good thing in terms of coordinating resources, in terms of making sure that the right people get to the right place at the right time. Unfortunately, it is possible that there could be liability as a result of offering that assistance someplace else. Now, EMAC contemplates that, and under 192, it makes the receiving state responsible for any liability that results as a matter of providing that assistance from Minnesota to another state. And that's the right solution. It means that the responsibility and the accountability for liability will be held with the state that has direction and control. So, for instance, if we're going to provide assistance in Louisiana, and if something goes wrong, then it is Louisiana who defends and indemnifies the responding state's employees. EMAC specifies that protection for state employees and helping in another jurisdiction. It does not speak to the protections for local government employees, who again are very often the folks who are sent to assist in those emergencies. And it really doesn't make a lot of sense to offer less protection for city-county employees than it does for state employees. That would, in essence, provide a disincentive for local governments to offer their assistance. So the goal is to take an already very good system, that EMAC system, and to improve it by extending those liability protections to the local governments who have the resources that will be most valuable in a time of crisis. That clarification is in keeping with the spirit of EMAC as it already exists, as well as the spirit of public safety and emergency services. It will also make it feasible for cities to continue providing emergency assistance in that time of emergency or disaster. So we thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And given that this, you're basically putting the public employees in the process that the liability all accrues to entities outside the state of Minnesota, is there a reciprocity issue here that by passing this we then take on in the state of Minnesota the liability for actions of public elected officials from other states that come here?
Representative Holberg, my understanding is that already exists with the other states that we have a compact with, that in fact the same relationship exists currently. It's just that Minnesota's law wasn't clear as part of that interstate compact. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, yes. The EMAC system is already a reciprocal system signed on to by all of the states. The problem with the particular Minnesota legislation is that it is silent as to how local government assistance will be treated. I can't tell you how other states address that. I'm not familiar with whether or not each other state has addressed the local government aspect of that or not.
And Representative Holberg. Madam Chair, so just to clarify, am I, so that maybe I'm incorrect in that current, if this does not pass, does the state of Minnesota assume liability for local employees from other states that come here?
Madam Chair, Representative, if this does not pass, Minnesota assumes liability for any other state who sends their employees. It would depend on whether Wisconsin, for instance, has in their legislation similar language making local government employees part of the state's assignment. So I can't.
So
it really depends.
Holbert. I'm just trying to figure out who trumps whom here. That's what I'm trying to figure out. So right now, Minnesota is liable for any local level employee of any state that comes here that has a local employee provision in their law, but because we are sending our local employees out to other states and do not have this provision, our local level employees may not be covered by other states. Is that correct?
Representative Sumpfer.
Actually, if I could clarify that the liability things are going to all be addressed in Representative Mullery's committee, which is why we're sending
it
there.
Oh, hey, I get to, I'm there. So
and you're
I'll
there.
Up now. And then Representative Sumpfer can maybe have the answers for me in the next committee.
That would be great. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representing the border community, the problem that they're trying to fix here is very real. We depend upon mutual aid from neighboring communities in North Dakota, and this is a real concern, and thank you, Representative Sumpfer and the League, for trying to fix this problem.
Further questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Sumpfer will renew his motion that House File 3456 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Sumpfer, let's do your other one. Representative Sumpfer moves that House File 3577 be recommended to pass and be placed in the General Register. Representative Sumpfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I have a slight verbal amendment, a small verbal amendment. The county board, in thinking about this recently and in the last few days, has contacted me, and they would like to have this apply only to auditor and treasurer. And so we need to amend and delete the word recorder on line 1.8 and on line 1.23.
Questions from members? Does staff have that? All right. Representative Stumper makes that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Stumper.
Members, my county board wants to do what many county boards have done and can do in the state of Minnesota, and that is combine some of their present elected offices into an administrative office. They have we have an auditor. This is for Houston County. We have an auditor and treasurer who are longtime elected officials who are in the process or soon will be retiring, and the county board simply wants to seize that opportunity to streamline our process and appoint one person to the two spots or combine those positions. It'll take 4/5 of the commissioners to do this. They have to hold a public hearing and adopt a resolution to do that. There is provisions in law for a reverse referendum if a petition of 10% of the voters in the last election requests that. And any office holders presently in office will be allowed to fulfill their present term.
All right, questions from members. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Stumper, on page 2, lines 9 through 13, will you tell me what that language means?
Representative Stumper.
See.
It's Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, are you referring to the language about the petition requirements?
Yes.
That's language that... drafting staff in the House of Senate have started adding at the request of some local officials that have talked to us over the last couple of years, that just puts people on notice that the petition has to meet the requirements of the Secretary of State's office. There is a statute and apparently at least one group of citizens put together a petition and went through the whole process and then found out the petition didn't meet the requirements of law, and this puts in the that there is a law that governs
decisions.
So that's what that sentence is there for.
All right. Thank you for that
clarification. Further questions from members? All right. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Stumper renews his motion that House File 3577 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Sorry.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Next, we have Representative Erickson. And Representative Lanning, would you like to move Representative Erickson's bill to the general register?
So moved.
All right. Representative Lanning moves House File 3313 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. 3313 allows for interim use permits, not ordinances, but interim use permits for counties, and that language is consistent throughout the bill with the definition on page 2. I have with me the zoning officer from Mille Lacs County, Michelle McPherson, who will go over some of the details.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle McPherson. I'm the Zoning and Environmental Services Administrator from Mille Lacs County, and I requested Representative Erickson propose this legislation. Essentially, the legislation would provide the same authority to counties that towns and cities already have in Minnesota Statutes 462-3597. It's a tool in the land use and zoning toolbox that counties can use to provide for interim uses in particular areas. It's a tool that's much easier to use than, say, a traditional overlay district or some other types of tools that we have. Specifically, interim uses are terminated by either a specific date or a specific event or a change in the zoning regulation. The proposed language in the bill is the exact same verbatim language that is in 462. And as a member of the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators, they are in support of the language as proposed, as well as AMC. And with that, I'll answer any questions that the committee may have.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill?
And Madam Chair, we did have a handout.
Yes,
I hope
we have received it.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Seeing none, Representative Lanning renews his motion that House File 3313 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next and last, we actually are 10 minutes ahead of schedule, is Representative Haas's bill. Representative Haas, please come to the table. Members, this is a controversial issue. I'm certain you've all been receiving your email. Representative Haas, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. It's good to be back into the local government committee. Fond memories of my time the committee, especially during the whole issue of eminent domain. Before you is House File 1254, which makes some changes when it comes to interim zoning abilities for local governments, and requires that local governments, that there is going to be a process for an interim ordinance, that it must be published and a public hearing must be held. There have been, I think, some claims batted here and about on this bill that I hope we are able to address today. I think, in my mind, this is a good government bill. This requires a public hearing, something that we always require of our local government, in most instances. We also require that publication be made when our local governments are making a significant decision affecting our community. This requires that. There are some concerns about what a completed application means, because within this bill it says that if there's a completed application, that a future interim ordinance cannot impact a project that has already submitted a completed application. We will discuss that today. A completed application takes a substantial amount of time to process. Cities, townships, counties have time to react and have time to implement an interim ordinance if need be. But without me rambling on, I do have a few testifiers here that I would like to have the ability to address the committee.
All right, Representative Mr. Coyle, sorry.
I hold no election certificate.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle from Larkin Hoffman. I represent the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. We've had substantial discussions with the city and county folks, Madam Chair, to see if we can make this bill less controversial. But in essence, what this bill is trying to deal with is a fairness issue that, in my case, residential developers encounter all too frequently, and that is they make an application for a residential development, and unbeknownst to them, there's a desire at some level within the city to impose a moratorium on the development of property throughout the city for some reason. And they may have submitted their application, they've paid their fees, they've done all their engineering work, they've submitted everything that the city or the county requires, only to find out after the fact that a moratorium is desired. The language that we're supporting today, which will be offered in the form of an amendment, would essentially grandfather only a residential development application that has been filed and accepted by the city or the county and is in conformance with the established regulations of those two jurisdictions. And that's it. It's a fairness issue by itself. There are other aspects of the bill that folks have concerns about, and we've indicated that on behalf of the builders, at least, and I won't speak for the author, that if the wishes of the committee were to pare the bill back to only protect a properly submitted residential development application, that would be acceptable to us. And I believe that the cities and counties have indicated a willingness to accept that language, realizing that we still have some issues to work out and that there's a hearing that needs to occur on the Senate side. I'll stop there, let Mr. Pankinen testify as a builder, or a developer rather, and then certainly respond to any questions. And I don't want to speak for the cities or counties, they can speak for themselves.
Representative Holberg.
My question is to the amendment. I thought they were going to move the amendment.
Yeah,
so.
Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Bruce Pankinen. I'm trained as a city planner. I practiced as a city planner for 10 years, and for the last 30 years I've been a residential developer in the Twin Cities. So over my tenure I've learned how to spell zoning. It's when a community in their zoning ordinance outlines all the requirements that are necessary to complete an application for a jurisdictional approval, and they take my check and they process it, I think it's only fair that the board, city council, town, or county, consider my application. I've filled out all of their forms. I've submitted all the documents that they require. I've worked with the planning staff to ameliorate all the differences, and they take my check and cash it, and I want a hearing. I want the 60-day rule to take effect and not come up with some ordinance that will delay me for upwards of a year and a half with amendments. It only seems to be fair, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, to the testifier, it would seem to me that once your check has been taken in cash, that we are now entering into contract law. My question is, has this ever been challenged in court, especially after a municipality has actually cashed a check?
Mr. Clark.
Madam Chair, Representative Diskin, there have been challenges, and almost uniformly the governmental agencies prevail. The Minnesota Supreme Court and other bodies have said that when local governments enact moratoria, at virtually any time, the property owner loses.
Further questions? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to be clear about the proposed amendment. If an application has not been received for a development, the local unit of government could then still impose them with moratorium, correct?
Yes.
It's only after the application has been received that...
Representative Hodge.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, it's not application received, it's application completed. And I think there's a distinction that we have to make there. You know, as a former mayor yourself, when I was mayor of St. Joseph, we would have housing subdivision proposals come in front of our city. The application process was intensive. There was an initial application. There had to be review by city staff, and there had to be review by different entities throughout the city. Only after that occurred would that application be considered completed. And I think we really need to get this out in the air, that you don't just take an application and drop it on the desk at City Hall and it's considered complete. I think within the amendment that we have before you, gives the local unit of government ample time to react to any concerns, to hold a public hearing, to be able to initiate an interim ordinance that may prohibit or limit any development. But it's that completed application that we have to keep our eyes on. It's not just a received application.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I'm trying to get at here is when still can a local unit of government impose a moratorium? Are you saying that they can only impose a moratorium if it's before the application has been completed? That once it's completed, they can no longer impose a moratorium?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, the intent would be to only protect a filed application, but as for the moratorium itself, they can still enact it whenever they wish, and it would apply to any other property that is subject to the moratorium. So let's assume there's 100 acres that are going to be affected by the moratorium, 20 acres of which there is a pending application before the jurisdiction. That application, if it's complete, would be grandfathered essentially under the moratorium, but the balance of the 100 acres would be subject to the moratorium.
But it would have to...
Representative Lanning.
It would have to be completed.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Representative Stumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This issue has really been contentious. We had a couple meetings in my office in the last session. We had a meeting today about it. There was an agreement in the last session, at the end of the last session, that the parties at odds here would get together and discuss and try to negotiate some solutions to this. Has that happened? To my knowledge, it hasn't happened. Would either of you like to comment on that?
Representative
or anyone?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Trumper. Last year, we had several meetings to try to come to a consensus or to some kind of conclusion. Several amendments were drafted. My door is always open. And if somebody wants to meet with me and come to a compromise, I am always more than willing. I believe that some have claimed otherwise, which is, to put it mildly, I'm disappointed.
But in no respect have I denied any ability to try to come to a compromise. It's a two-way street. Efforts were made, substantial efforts have been made in the last year. In fact, we even asked the committee to not hear the bill last year. So I think those actions speak for itself.
Representative Sumford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Haas, I don't know exactly about what you're commenting on, but I know the party, the people who are most at odds about this, were supposed to have some negotiations or discussions, and to my knowledge, that did not happen.
Representative Sumper, why don't we let those people testify on behalf of their perspective as well as we go forward?
That's fine. And, you know, I guess my question to the two witnesses is, how big of a problem is this? I mean, is this something that occurs every week here in the state of Minnesota, or every month, or how often are developers held up because local units of government adopt interim ordinances?
Mr. Coyle?
Madam Chair, Representative Jumper, I can't give you a specific count, but I can tell you as a lawyer who advises real estate development clients throughout the state of Minnesota on these issues, it is the hardest question that I have to answer from them when they say to me, I've been working with the staff in the city for 6 or 8 or 12 months on this application. I've submitted all of the engineering details they asked of me and have expended, in many cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars in doing that. And then they find out, after they've submitted all those materials, and in some cases even having gone through the Planning Commission process and received a recommendation, they get stopped by a moratorium. And I would say very respectfully to you and others, it's just unfair. They've gone through the process, they've met the rules. It's guided for residential use in our case, as the amendment would speak to it. We just think it's a matter of balancing the fairness. It's not like there's a sneaky process that somebody's going through here where it's going to catch the city by surprise.
Well, I just would like to comment that I was on the city council for 6 years, and I participated in at least two that I can remember off the top of my head. So, Representative Stumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can ask then, what are the reasons for this? If you've submitted all this information, you work with planning departments. I mean, you know, are the local units of government just being arbitrary about this, or do they recognize some real needs that they feel they have to address it? I guess I've served on local government too, and we didn't, but other units of government in my county have adopted interim ordinances from various times, and they usually have a pretty justifiable reason. And I guess I'm wondering, I recognize the expenditures and the commitment of resources that developers have put forward, but, you know, I don't know what other recourse local units of government have if they don't have that ability at some point, especially when the submission is complete, to say, we may not be prepared to handle this.
Representative Haas, would you like Mr. Coyle to take that question?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Shumper. I think we need to remember that throughout the process, all of our local units of government still have the ability, even if this legislation passes, to pass an interim ordinance and to limit development. I believe that when we ask for an individual who's proposing a development to be responsible and to provide information to the city, the township, or the county, that there is also a reciprocal responsibility. That the city, township, or county also be prepared and take into account any information. And if during that application time, before it's complete, they determine that they cannot handle the decision before them, they still can do the interim ordinance. It's only after a completed application. And I think we need to understand that it does take a substantial amount of time to get to that point. But when we ask or demand of others to provide the city with information, I think we should also have a responsibility as local units of government and to landowners and to their landowner rights to be able to have a response, I think, a response that's adequate and also fair to the landowner.
All right. I'm going to let you have one more question, but otherwise we're not going to have time to get to the opposing side.
Sure.
Representative Stumper.
Just a quick question, Representative Haas. Doesn't a 60-day notice simply accomplish that? That they have to act on an application within 60 days?
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Trumper. That's after the application is official and completed. Yes. But, I mean, during that same time, I mean, while they're going through the process of an application, the city should have the responsibility, if they can't handle it, to then do an interim ordinance and not at the last moment. Just one more point on this. There can even be interim ordinances passed in which properties can only be used for agriculture purposes, yet they're still being taxed at a residential tax rate, which is substantially higher. And that's another issue of unfairness, but I'll talk about that on another day.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I just had one small question after having served on local government for many years, like most of us here. You process the permit, the application. At what point does the public gain knowledge of that? Not until the Planning Commission meeting? Or, I mean, if you can have a complete application and then it goes to the Planning Commission meeting, at which time the public would have notification of it, and I'm wondering, when can the public weigh in on this?
Mr. Coyle.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, as I'm sure you recall from Fridley's ordinances, every city has a requirement that if you have a subdivision application or a zoning application relating to a residential project, if the Planning Commission is the first line of defense, they're going to have a public hearing process that requires a mandatory notice that goes out to affected property owners within, in most cases, 350 feet. If the city council or the town board or the county board chooses to conduct a public hearing, it may be tied to the county board or the city council's process. But in most cities, at least the ones that I am familiar with, that public notice process would occur at the Planning Commission level before the Planning Commission's public hearing would occur, so well in advance of any final decision.
Representative Scalzi.
I don't know about Fridley, but I was in Little Canada. But
oh, sorry.
I pretty much the same. But I'm thinking that, so then at that point, the application is completed. So that would be over and done with before the public had a hearing on the issue.
Mr. Coyle.
Well, the application would be complete, but Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, the application would be complete, but the decision process for the city or the county would still be up in the air. I mean, if it's demonstrated that there is a traffic concern, if it's demonstrated that there is a wetland concern, if it's demonstrated that there is a some other legitimate public health, welfare, safety basis to say no, it's not like the local jurisdiction is forced to approve the application. They still have their traditional discretion to say no. They just can't say no based on imposing a moratorium, which is what happens today. That's the unfairness.
All right, I need to go to the opposing side because we've given you a significant amount of time. So anyone who is interested in testifying in opposition to the bill, please come to the table. State your name for the record. I have a few on the list, so if you need me to call you out, I will. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be cognizant of the time. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities. We do oppose the bill as it is currently drafted for a couple of reasons. One is that and I don't know if we've looked at the amendment yet, but the way the bill is drafted as it came to the committee leaves a 10-day window of time from when the public notice has to be given until the event happens where a moratorium can go into effect. During that time period, anyone who might be affected by a moratorium could submit applications, and if they were completed applications, they would be exempt from the moratorium. It could trigger a flood of applications for whatever the proposed moratorium was trying to control, just a single issue of. Furthermore, and I think part of it came up in Representative Trumper's comments earlier, frequently we do have situations where what comes up is not what the local unit of government was expecting. It's got challenges to it that they don't know how to address. It is not due to a flaw in the application that they need more time. It's due to the fact that as a local unit of government, they don't know how they're going to address things like infrastructure needs and other aspects. It is not a weakness of the application. It would be a completed application. So while we understand the fairness issue that's trying to be addressed here, we do not feel that the language, the way it's set up, helped us to achieve that and actually could cause a lot more problems than it would end up solving in many cases.
be happy to respond to questions.
I could ask if you participated in any meetings in the interim to help address some of the concerns to see if we could have some compromise. And if you haven't, if you would be prepared to participate in meetings between now and the next session.
Madam Chair, members, we did not participate in any interim meetings on this issue in particular. We have spoken considerably with the builders and others about land use issues in general, and we are happy to always do that.
All right. Okay, next testifier, go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jay Squires with the law firm of Bratliff Brozak, speaking on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties. My firm represents municipalities, counties, towns, cities, and school districts around the state. I have been involved in drafting moratoria. I've been involved in assisting clients in moratoria issues. The concern that the Association of Counties has, and I have as well, is that initially this bill was drafted to apply to all uses, and the proposed amendment limits it to residential uses, which is certainly a move in the right direction. But my comment is that the purpose of moratorium, to prevent surprises, to prevent situations where the municipality is not prepared at a planning level to deal with a particular proposal, can apply to residential proposals just as it does to adult uses or infectious waste facilities or something that on its face seems a lot more terrible. And I would give one example to the committee. I represent the city of Red Wing. If you're familiar with the city of Red Wing, they have a beautiful riverfront area, which is in the process of substantial talk to redevelopment. A number of years ago, an application came in. As the city started to get involved in general discussions at a local level in redevelopment, an application came in for a predominantly residential use in the redevelopment area. That application, ultimately, as the city went through the comprehensive planning process, would have really posed substantial problems and impediments to the city's effort to have an overall redevelopment of the area. I guess in simple terms, it would have cut the heart out of the watermelon of that redevelopment district. So under the current proposal, that being a residential use, some of the same planning concerns would have existed. Some of the same needs of the municipality to protect the integrity of its process to be able to apply to a moratorium exists in that case. In another case, the County of Rice was involved with a residential subdivision, a small one. And there are situations with residential developments as well where you get caught with the, oops, our ordinance doesn't work very well in this situation. No ordinance is perfect. And that is also a protection where moratoria are necessary. In that particular case, a hole in the density limitations on the residential development, something that would have had posed environmental problems to a particular lake. And in that case, the county was able, though it was a residential development, to be able to impose a moratorium to give itself time to address that particular issue. So I think we have concerns, even though it's, as I mentioned, the right direction, that it is a particular problem. And then the last comment, there were comments here about fairness and the need of the municipality not to act arbitrarily. I agree with that. I think that municipalities should not act arbitrarily and unfairly. But there are protections in the existing legal system for that. There are court decisions that say that municipalities cannot act arbitrarily in imposing a moratorium. And in fact, if you look at the statutes themselves, in particular the 394 provision dealing with counties, there's a statutory requirement that they act in good faith as they consider imposing moratoria. So I think with respect to the fairness, I do agree with that. AMC does agree with that. There are protections in place. It is important from a matter of policy that the counties and other municipalities still have the ability to use that tool in situations where they've been surprised or where a residential proposal will pose a substantial or could pose a substantial planning problem to them.
All right, thank you. Members, we have just a few minutes left, so if you're in the audience and you want to testify against this bill, you need to come to the table. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Bobby King with the Land Stewardship Project. We're a membership organization that works on sustainable agriculture and family farming in rural communities, and we've done a lot of work at the Capitol over the years on protecting what we call township rights and local control. And last year when the bill came up, we were finally opposed to it, There were meetings in Representative Jumper's office. I thought we were making headway with the developers on coming to some type of agreement. Then the bill was pulled. I thought that there were going to be discussions over the interim. Now, I know Representative Hawks, you're welcome. You're always, we've talked to you before, and we'll talk to you. And if we get anything to give you the impression that we're suggesting you're not open to talking, I apologize. And if some of our members have called you and said that, we'll correct the record that way, because that's not true. The last time that I know of and that we were involved in where the powers of an interim ordinance were suggested, where were supposed to be weakened, was when Governor Polanyi, around feedlot issues, had it as a package. That was very controversial. It received extensive news coverage. There was a very broad and deep and ongoing debate that lasted over the summer and then into the session, and we came up with a perfect compromise where everybody was unhappy. But it stuck so far. No one's come back to the table on it as it relates to feedlots. But I just wanted to tick through the bill quickly and talk about our main objections, and I'll focus on the one that relates most directly to the new amendment, as I understand it. It's worth noting, though, that the bill does limit the time an interim ordinance can be placed put in place for counties from 1 year, from 2 years to 1 year. Now, going back 4 or 5 years even, that the same debate happened as it relates to townships, and the argument was, well, you know, you should be able to get it done in a year. Why do you need 2 years? Well, if you're a township and you don't have any ordinances, and you're working primarily with volunteers, it might take you 2 years. Some rural counties have limited resources. There are a few rural counties that don't have ordinances. They should, but they don't. And if there was an emergency, they might need more than 1 year in those cases. So the compromise on the, as related to townships, was you could extend it if you were starting from scratch. The biggest concern probably was the fact that merely submitting an application could give you an exemption. And as originally drafted, it just says any use. So, no government official, no resident, no elected official would know the application's put on the table. Let's say it's an unanticipated use. Let's say it's a racetrack in rural Minnesota. Your hands would be tied then. If it was drafted, it moved forward. Now, as it relates specifically just to subdivisions and the issue of a permitted application for subdivisions, I think our biggest concern there is that there's no public process going on during the process of deeming an application complete. Is the way I understand it, it's developer to staff. So even an elected official might not know. Certainly neighbors to the site wouldn't know. But once it's deemed complete, an important tool for addressing what could be a problem is now off the table. And you can think of a situation where a county deems it complete, but the township doesn't want this project. They think it's bad and they don't have any zoning. They can't simply turn it down. They've got no zoning. They need access to the tool of an interim ordinance to address it. Then on the 10-day public hearing,
you know, I'm actually going to have to interrupt you a little bit because we're going to run out of time.
Okay.
But I want to make sure that this gentleman has a chance to...
Yeah, he drove further than I did.
Yeah, well. And my question would be, would you be prepared to work with Representative Haas in the interim to work out these issues?
Yeah, with all parties.
With all parties.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Hi, Alan Parrish. I'm from Todd County, Minnesota. I'm a township officer, and as of tomorrow, which happens to be the second Tuesday of March, I'll be there 21 years. As a township officer, I see this as it was written, and there's been some amendments we haven't had a chance to look at them close enough to determine just how well they correct the problems. But as it was written, it surely was a hindrance to township for the ability to place interim ordinances or their ability to. And like Bobby had just admitted, the time that we need, especially the townships that do not have a planning and zoning. And the reason they don't have planning and zoning is because something has never come upon them so that they need it, and it's a costly process to develop it for them. When they start from scratch, it takes a while for them to get their hands around one of these projects, because when they do an interim ordinance,
they can't just look at just one issue. They have to look at the whole spectrum. So they have to do a complete comp plan that sets a complete ordinance so that they have they can't segregate just one issue out against the developer or whoever's planning to do a project. But with that, I would still oppose the bill as it was presented. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And would you be prepared to work with Representative Hosh and
yes.
other members on the issue? Yep. All right. Members, we have gone over our time. I want to thank everyone for coming. This is an important issue that I think needs to be talked about. I think it's important that people work on this issue in the interim. That's what they had said they were going to do last time. We don't yet have an agreement, and so that is what I'm going to ask you to do. And if you need the help of me as the chair to make certain that discussions are taking place, you just let me know.
Madam Chair, thank you for the committee time. I don't know if you want to move the amendment to... No.
Okay. I'm going to lay the bill over.
Okay. To your liking, Madam Chair, but thank you for the committee time. I'm always open for working for a compromise, and it has to be two-sided. So I will be more than happy as the bill sponsor to continue that effort.
All right. With that, members, we are adjourned.